This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
Keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Night Transmissions, of course. Number 125, to be exact. If exactitude is required, probably not desired. Oh yeah, I'm Gary Clinton. Don't think I need to check my underwear for that. I'm pretty sure I'm Gary Clinton. And I'm pretty sure the first episode tonight is an episode of Crime Classics, which is sometimes called a docudrama. I've done that myself. But you know, sometimes that's too grand a claim. To start off with the person of the host, Thomas Hyland, is completely fictional. There is not now, nor has there ever been a Thomas Hyland. There was a Lou Merrill who played him rather admirably. This particular episode tonight, from January the 22nd of 1954, Crime Classics sometimes strayed considerably from the facts. I'm not going to tell you very much about the real story. I think, if anything, the real story is maybe a bit more interesting than the program tonight. But if I told you about it, I think it would spoil it for you. Kind of did me, having done my research before listening to the program, and therefore knowing to what degree the program deviated from historical fact. In the case of this episode, I think it's just best to say that the program was suggested by historical facts. Now, if you're interested in the historical facts, well, I got you covered there, too. If you go to nighttransmissions.com, click into show 125, scan down the first segment, you'll find towards the bottom of segment one, you'll find a link documenting the actual facts of the case. It's well worth checking out, but I would suggest that you listen to this before you check out the facts.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Hyland with another true story of crime. Listen. That was Jacko. Jacko, the three-quarter Irish setter. A good dog, usually a well-behaved dog, friend to the children of Manchester Village, Vermont. An inquisitive dog. Whatever disturbs him isn't buried very deep. Listen to him digging. Smart dog. He's found what he was after. He's tugging at it. Gets it. Good dog. What have you got there, Jacko? A bone. Looks like a leg bone, doesn't it? A human leg bone. Tonight, my report to you on the Bourne Brothers and the Hangman, a study in Nip and Tuck.
Crime Classics, a series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Hyland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Mr. Thomas Hyland.
Fighting battles on Lake Champlain in 1812, but across the state, forests away and mountains apart, the village of Manchester sent peaceful fans of chimney smoke into the February air. It was ebb of winter and edge of spring. It was snow flurry and thaw and chill sunlight. Here, the Battenkill River flowed swift and dark down from the Green Mountains, encrusted icily near its banks and past the village, then flowed swift and dark away. And where the snow had melted, the soil glistened and was rich and black. Farmhouses gleamed white. And where the furrow began, the shallow furrow that deepened and roughened and slowly rose up the mountainside and became the gorge that cut across the face of Mount Equinox. Where it gently began was the backyard of the house of Russell and Sally Colvin. And inside it...
He's sleeping.
Asleep? Why? Why asleep? What did you put him to sleep for?
Please.
There's moonlight on the snow, and there's moonlight on the mountain, and I promised my son he'd see.
Why do you do that? Why do you fill his mind with lies and fancies?
There's little men on the mountain tonight, and I told my son he'd see them. Lewis!
Don't wake him, Russell. Don't wake him.
Stop hanging on my arm, woman.
Russell!
Stop hanging on my arm!
Crazy! Crazy man!
Wake! Wake, son. I'll bundle you, and it's up the mountain we'll go tonight with you riding my shoulders. And little men we'll find. Them at their bowls and singing and dancing. And we'll join them. Come with me, son. Up the path the moonlight makes on the mountain snow. Up the path the moonlight makes.
As any mother knows, this is an upsetting experience. And as Sally Colvin knew, this was not the first experience of its kind. Sometimes her husband would hoist her son on his back and walk away from the house and not come back for days at a time. And when they did, they would smile at each other secret smiles and say nothing of where they had been. And there were secret words between them that Sally could not understand, and signs and small patterns of dance, and then great bursts of laughter. And this time, the time when Russell took his son up the path the moonlight made, and they returned 2 days later...
Sleeping. Now you'll sleep the day away and the night. The sun. And dream of the fancies we've seen in the little men. Sleep. Sleep.
Tell me. What...
Shh.
No.
Sister, oh, come in. What can I do for you in the morning?
Hold me.
What? Oh, sister to me, what troubles you? Him again? Your husband?
Yes, oh yes.
And what?
What he's doing to my son. Soon.
What?
My son will become as mad as my husband. They speak of creatures in the mist in the gorge. And starbursts and moon. Brother Stephen Ford.
What do you want me to do?
I don't know.
He's a stronger man than I. There's not much I can do.
But you and our brother Jesse Bourne, together you could do it.
Don't speak to me of Jesse, him that I hate.
But me? What of me?
Speak no more of it.
Save me, Stephen Bourne. That's what I ask of you.
Sister...
Save me.
How?
Very well, you know how. You and Jesse. You know it and you have said it. Come with me to our brother's forge and make peace and save me, your sister. Brother, stands here before you and wishes to friend with you because... Jesse!
Out of my way, there's work to be done.
I'm no blacksmith, Jesse, and I've not got the sinews of you, but listen to your sister and what her trouble is, or I'll try you.
Will you now? Will you? Me who can split your head to your heart in a stroke. Try me, will you? Then do it.
Stop it! Stop it! Listen. Listen to me. I'm being killed, and my death is the madness around me.
What are you saying?
Of her husband.
Let her say it.
And what he does to my child.
I've heard strangenesses in the village of your husband, sister. And when I've heard them, I've smiled to myself in remembering. This is the man you needed to marry, sister. Would die without, sister. And now he's a daft and a loon. Now he's...
Hear her out.
Say on, sister.
He takes Louis with him on walkings. For days. And they return. And there are secrets and madnesses.
And loneliness for you.
I care nothing of it. I care only for my son.
Jesse. Jesse.
Take his hand, Jesse Bourne, and be brothers again. For there is a bond now. The need to help me.
Yes.
And now listen to me. There where the ravine starts. By the field where it is rocky. I will send my husband there.
A plotter, our sister.
I will send my husband there. Tomorrow in the morning. Will you be there? Will the both of you be there?
We'll be there.
Now, hear to me, son. The way I do it. Come a goblin, come a teeny. Come an elfin, come a greeny. Come about, come about, come about all. And you shall...
Russell.
I'll finish it for you later, son.
Russell. And there you are. With your son mute and agape at you again.
What do you want?
It's a new morning and the new season of spring's coming in with it.
And so?
And so there's work.
And you need not tell me of it. There's no work I do not do on this farm. I need no telling of it.
In the upper field and where the rocks are easy to pull from the ground now that the thaw has softened it.
I know of it. You need not remind me.
Tonight the night frost may harden the ground again.
I know it.
Then go.
I'll be back, son. Think hard of the verse I taught to you.
Away he went, did Russell Colvin, on this new morning toward the upper field. He'd not gone 20 yards when he stopped.
Gold.
Sparkle of sun on Vermont granite. Small pool of sparkle.
Gold.
And he picked it up and put it in his pocket. Then on again, the long way around, through the grove of naked spruce, to give throat to the new season.
Oh!
And on, to the brook now. And stop beside it. And kneel beside it and listen.
Yes. Yes.
Then through a thicket and into the upper field and the surprise in store for him.
Hello, Russell.
Hello, Jesse Bourne. Stephen.
Oh, brother-in-law.
What do you hear?
To help you, Russell.
To do what?
To help you clear the rocks now that the ground is soft with thaw.
And how do you know I'm here to do that?
How indeed.
I need not your help.
I'm hearing you do, brother-in-law.
I'm hearing that way, too.
We're in hearing you don't do well by our sister, Russell. That's what we hear most of.
And who is saying that?
Our sister, your wife, saying it, Russell.
More wife than sister, so it's not of your business. So it's off the land with you, the two of you.
Oh, now indeed.
What you heft in that branch for, Stephen?
I'm aiming to... brain you with it.
You are aiming the same, Jesse?
Going to help.
Then let's get to it and we'll see.
Let's get to it indeed.
Ah! Stephen Bourne used the branch as a club, and with excellent teamwork, he and his brother Jesse won the fight. It was a good spring. April of 1812 was the gentlest in the memory of those who lived on the soft shoulder of Mount Equinox in Vermont. There were rumors of marchings and torch and war outside, but no one paid much attention. They were more important things, church, crops, and children. Living to be done in the Green Mountains, the crackling air to be breathed, roam away through the soft fall of twilight and press a cheek against the warmth of an animal. Wondrous sunsets and tomorrow a wondrous dawn. Good place and good time, this valley. And one morning, as a matter of fact, on the morning after the Bourne brothers had done an errand for their sister.
Come in. Oh, good morning, Mrs. Wyman.
And to you, Mrs. Colvin.
A sweet morning.
Tis.
And what may I do for you?
It's Wednesday.
And so it is.
So I've come again so your mister can drive me to the village again. He to shop for you and me for mine.
He's not here.
Oh, no. In the field, then?
Not in the field.
Oh, of course he is not, for I saw your son Louis at play just outside the door, and he would be in the fields with his daddy dear. Were his daddy dear in the fields?
You'll be late to market, Mrs. Wyman.
Where's the dear man, your husband, Mrs. Colvin?
Gone.
Where gone?
To the mountain.
Oh?
I think.
And when will he return?
I don't know.
Oh, such a dear man. And the dear fancies he sees and tells you of. Ah, oh, what a fortunate woman you are, Mrs. Colvin.
I've cleaning to do, Mrs. Wyman.
Busy you are, I know, Mrs. Colvin, preparing supper for you and your beautiful child. But it's a month since the village has seen your husband last. And for the last week it's been raining. And if the dear Mr. Colvin is in the mountains, as you say, what then, Mrs. Colvin? What then?
Maybe. Maybe.
Maybe what?
Maybe he has gone to war.
It's a year now, Mrs. Colvin. Have you heard from the dear man? Ah, it's a cruel war. I came to wish the all of you. You, Mrs. Colvin, and you, Stephen Bourne, and Jesse Bourne, a happy new year to you. May 1817 be a blessing to all of you.
And to you, Mrs. Wyman.
Happy new year, Mrs. Wyman.
Happy new year.
And a pity Mr. Colvin's not here. I suppose he'll never return now, will he? Happy New Year.
Now stop your crying, Sally.
A boy's a boy.
Only 14. My son, Louis.
I run off to join the militia. What's that? It's most what all boys doing now.
Maybe I've failed.
What are you saying, sister?
Maybe the whole thing was done wrong.
What wrong?
7 years since he's had no father. Maybe his father should have been close to him.
Loneliness and... again, sister.
Poor my son. Oh!
Oh! What's the outcry? See what, Stephen?
Oh, Stephen Bourne!
What is it, Sheriff Skinner?
See there! A fire to Dr. Glazier's barn. Fetch a bucket in quick.
Yes.
Jesse, there's a fire to Dr. Glazier's barn. You surely know the barn, Jesse.
Fire!
And in 1819, fires were not very easy to control. It was a matter of having enough men and enough buckets to reach from the fire to the stream. And Dr. Glazier's barn was not notably close to the stream, nor were there enough men nor buckets. So the fire had its own way. It burned the barn to the ground. And later, when the ashes had cooled and while Sheriff Skinner was consoling Dr. Glazier on his loss, the sheriff's dog...
Ah, what you digging there, Jacko? Find something, Jacko? Bring it here, Jacko. Let's see what you got there. A bone. Funny looking bone, big bone. What kind of bone would you say this was, Dr. Glazier?
Leg bone. Human.
Don't say.
Not positive. Could be, though.
Let's take a look, Jacko, where you found this bone. Hand me that stick of wood, will you, Doctor, so I can make this hole a little bigger.
Where I used to store my potatoes to keep them from freezing.
A button now. And look here, a knife. Funny-looking knife.
Let me see it. I know the knife.
Truth now, whose?
Russell Colvin's knife.
Russell Colvin now.
He's not been around.
6 years, seven.
It's his knife, all right. And that's a button off his coat, too.
And this is a human leg bone, you're saying, Doctor?
I'm not saying it's not a human leg bone.
Let's get along, Jacko. Come on, boy.
A few words about Sheriff Silas Skinner. A good man, had been sheriff of the county for nearly 20 years, and there wasn't a man who could say he hadn't got a fair shake from old Silas, or woman either. An honest man with no bias nor prejudice. A direct man.
Where's your husband, Sally?
Why, I don't know.
A man of few words.
You kill him?
No.
Who killed him, Sally?
My brother Jesse killed him, Sheriff.
A cautious man.
Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. But I'm arresting you till I find out which.
A man of his word.
Jesse?
Yes, Sheriff?
You kill your brother-in-law, Russell Colvin?
No, Sheriff, I did not.
Who did?
My brother Stephen did.
Maybe he did and maybe he didn't. But I'm arresting you till I find out which.
Sheriff Silas Skinner sees it through.
Stephen?
Yes, Sheriff?
I locked up your sister and I locked up your brother. And I'm putting you behind bars, too.
On what charge, Sheriff?
For murdering.
Murdering who?
Russell Colvin.
I didn't murder him, Sheriff.
Jesse said you did.
Jesse's lying.
I've known Jesse for long. He don't lie.
He's starting to now when he says I murdered.
You didn't murder him by yourself. That's what you're saying, isn't it, Steve?
I'm saying that right enough.
Your sister have anything to do with the murdering?
Well, not that I know of.
I'm going to tell you something, boy.
What?
I'm going to tell you something, son.
What?
You say to me what happened, it'll be easier for you.
What do you mean?
A little jail, that's all. No hanging.
There's a handshake that goes with it?
There is indeed.
Here's my hand, Sheriff.
And mine. Now, how was it done, son? How was it done, boy?
Russell Colvin was on his rocky upper field...
And that's where you done it, son?
And my brother got on one side of him. I got to the other.
And that's how you done it, boy?
I hit him with a tree branch.
And Jesse with his fist?
That's right.
That's right. And that's the way you killed him?
Yes, sir.
Then you took him to another farm?
Doc Glazier's.
And to that barn?
Doc Glazier's.
And buried him?
Yes, sir.
We'll write this out, son, and you'll sign it, won't you, boy?
Just a little jail?
Boy, son.
Just a little jail?
I shook your hand.
Then I'll sign it.
Good boy.
Stop taking on so, Stephen Bourne. Your brother Jesse's not acting up the way you are.
They found us guilty.
Well, you confess.
They're gonna hang us. You said just a little jail. You said no hanging.
I did what I could.
You said no hanging.
Now you listen to me. You killed your brother-in-law and you confessed to it and you had a trial by jury and they found you guilty. And the judge said hanging. Now that's the laws applied to you and your brother. So don't carry on.
Let's do a thing, Sheriff.
What thing?
Put an advertisement in the newspapers.
An advertisement? For what?
For Russell Colvin. Put a description in. And say, life depends on him turning up.
You crazy? You killed him. You confessed you killed him.
Who knows of Russell Colvin? Whether killed, he stayed killed. He and his moonlight little people. Do it.
Now, don't order me, son.
Please.
Huh?
Please do it.
Well, all right, son.
I have a copy here of the Rutland Herald, a newspaper of the time, which was circulated throughout this area of Vermont. I would like to read to you a classified ad which appeared in the issue of November 26, 1819. Printers of newspapers throughout the United States are desired to publish that Stephen Bourne of Manchester in Vermont is sentenced to be executed for the murder of Russell Colvin, who has been absent about 7 years. Any person who can give information of said Colvin may save the life of the innocent by making
immediate communication. Colvin is about 5 feet 5 inches, light complexion, light colored hair, blue eyes, and about 40 years of age. Why? That sounds like our hand, Russell. Except it doesn't say about a boy being with him. I'll see who it is. Russell! Russell, now! What was you doing, Russell?
Talking to my boy, Lewis.
Your son, ain't he?
My son.
They're looking for a man named Russell in Manchester.
Oh?
It's going to be a hanging unless they find a man named Russell. Russell Colvin. You once said you was from Manchester.
I am.
They looking for you?
I'm Russell Colvin.
It's my duty to see you get back to Manchester, Russell.
Yes, it is.
And so, 2 days before the scheduled hanging, Russell Colvin again appeared in Manchester. And the Bourne boys were not hanged. They were set free. What about the bone? Well, it was never proven to be a human bone. And the knife and button, Russell's, how had they gotten there? Russell always smiled when he was asked that. And what did his wife say to all this?
You can come home if you want.
I don't want you no more.
I hear our son's with you.
Yes, ma'am, he is.
How did he find you 100 miles away?
Oh, the little people told him where I was. Them that lives on the path the moonlight makes. They told him.
According to the report I have right here.
In just a moment, Thomas Highland will tell you about next week's crime classic. The Bourne Brothers, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Virginia Gregg was heard as Sally, Lamont Johnson as Russell, William Conrad as Stephen, and Jack Crucian as Jesse. Featured in the cast were Irene Tedrow, Joseph Kearns, and Herb Butterfield. Bob Lamond speaking.
Thank you. Good night.
Amazing new Biotex acts with a biological action to soak out the stubbornest stains and loosen dirt. New Biotex is great for all textiles and synthetics, wipes and colors. It contains no bleach. Get amazing new Biotex today and let soaking do the washing.
Coming up next is an episode of Lights Out, which everybody regards as one of the most famous radio shows of all times. It was created by Willis Cooper in 1939. Sorry, I meant to say 1934. And would be passed on to Arch Obler in 1936. We'll hear a little more from Arch Obler later in the show. The radio program itself would succumb to its mortality in 1947. But the franchise did not end with the radio show. Lights Out would turn up on TV from 1949 to 1952. And even since then, there have been occasional attempts to revive the series that never really met with any notable success. Tonight's show is from December the 15th of 1942 and is called Knock at the Door. It's about an old lady who made quite a splash as she went down the well. Okay, but really it's not about that. It's about the trouble her ghost makes after she went down the well. All right, I'm sorry about that. I just couldn't help myself. I probably should do a little bit of writing before I sit down to do the intros to this show. It wouldn't hurt. On the other hand, things would lose a bit of their spontaneity. Will you buy that? I hope you'll buy that. Please buy that. Because other than that, I've got no excuse, and I'd have to admit to being lazy.
The performance shall commence momentarily. We would like to remind you that all photography or recording of any kind is strictly prohibited. Please take a moment and turn off all cellular phones, pagers, and other electronic devices. I believe not a single soul would enjoy hearing your repugnant ringtone or seeing your sallow screen light. I entreat you, turn them off. Sit back, stay lively, and enjoy.
Lights out, everybody.
Out brings you stories of the supernatural and the supernormal, dramatizing the fantasies and the mysteries of the unknown. We tell you this frankly, so if you wish to avoid the excitement and tension of these imaginative plays, we urge you, calmly but sincerely, to turn off your radio now.
My name, Arch Overland. Tonight, another in our series of tales of the weird and the unusual. I plead with all mothers-in-law who listen to tonight's story not to send me poison pen letters. Fact of the matter is, I like mothers-in-law. I'm really not responsible for what happens in the twisted brains of my characters, am I? But first, before we start, Frank Martin has a word for you.
And now, lights out. Everybody.
Afraid to die? Who isn't? When I was just a kid, I used to wake up in the night and see the dark pressing all around me. And I'd get so scared, I'd think I was dead, buried. I'd try to scream. I couldn't. My voice, I'd know I was dead. I'd know it. I'd throw off the cover. I'd cry out, Mother, Mother! Oh, why did I yell out like that? Why should I be scared now? I want to die. I'd gotta die. It's cold here in the basement. I wonder if the grave is cold. Why don't I get it over with? The ropes around my neck. One step off the ladder and I'll hang and die. And I gotta die. I gotta die.
The wages of sin are death.
The wages of sin are death. Funny how I seem to hear the words the way my father used to say them. The wages of sin. But was it sin? No. It was hate. I killed her because I hated her. And I remember the first time we met. Jay had just married me. And we were walking along the street to his house.
Oh, Ella, you'll like my ma. Really, you will.
Well, I...
Sure, she's swell. Best woman in the world.
Is she?
Well, I mean... Well, you're my wife now. Ella, that proves what I think of you, don't it?
I guess it does.
Oh, you and Ma'll get along fine. Will this be a surprise to her? Well, here's the house. What do you think of it?
Well, it's all right.
Yeah. Well, in we go. Will Ma's eyes pop when she sees you? Pop right out, I'll bet you. Come on, Ma, open up. Got a surprise for you.
Jay, where have you been, son? Where? Oh.
Surprise, eh, Ma? Meet Ella.
Jay, you've brought home a woman. When she said it that way, looking at me, I knew I hated her. And that's the way it was from then on. I wasn't Jay's wife to her, but a woman. Stranger in her house. And it was her house and everything in it. Nothing Jay's, everything hers.
Ma, can I use your car to take Ella riding? Ma, mind if Ella plants some roses in your garden? Ma, is it all right if Ella uses...
That's the way it was. Hers, hers, everything hers. All I had was Jay, and he wasn't much. You can't blame me, you hear me? You can't blame me for not standing it. All my life I'd had nothing, and at last I was married, and I still had nothing. Her house, her car, her money, her son, I couldn't stand it, I tell you. So I killed him.
The wages of sin are death.
Why do I keep hearing Pa's words in my head? I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to do it. It's just that I want to sit here on top of a ladder and think and talk about everything for a little while. The last chance I'll get. Oh, like I said, I killed him. Well, not right away. I did it for weeks and months. But all the time inside of me, something was talking.
Kill her. Everything will be yours.
Everything will be yours. And then louder and louder until my head was filled with it. Louder and louder until I couldn't stand it no more. Louder and louder until I said, yes, I'll do it. Everything would be mine then. I always wanted it that way. It had to be that way. Here in this basement, that's where it happened. Jay went to work. I came down here. Oh, it wasn't very hard to do what I had to do. I remember every minute of it so well. Every minute. I called her, and she came down into the basement.
You call me, Ella?
Yes, I called you.
What's the matter?
Somebody took the lid off the sewer down here.
Land sakes alive. Now, who could have done that? Heavy iron cover like that. Jay wouldn't have done it.
Is it deep down there?
Of course it's deep. Ain't a sewer anyway. Covers an old well this building was built over.
Oh.
What are you owing about? Heard my son Jay tell you the same thing weeks ago.
Yes, he did tell me. Funny, I forgot. Oh, look.
What?
Down in the well, look.
I don't see nothing. What?
Oh, it's your well, isn't it, Mama? Your well. Everything is yours, so stay in it. Stay in it, Mama. Stay in it. Your well,
Mama, but everything else is mine now. Everything mine, mine.
And that's the way it was. Easy. Too easy. Jay came home. He said...
Hey, Ella, where's Ma?
I don't know. She wasn't here when I got back from the store. Must have gone out.
Oh. Well, she'll be back. Leave it to Ma.
But she didn't come back. How could she? Jay went to the police. They came around. They asked questions. They went away. And nothing happened. It was as easy as that.
Wages of sin are death. Wages of sin are death.
Oh, why do I keep hearing that in my head? Why? I'm going to die. Rope around my neck. Just a little bit longer talking. Just a little. She was gone. And I had her house and her son. And then I didn't want him. I tell you, he made me sick just to look at him. Mama, mama. I wanted to forget. And then one day, I got an idea. There was more room under that iron lid in the basement, wasn't there? That was it? Yes, that was it. Got free of her, now I get free of him. Sell the house, quick, get away, far away. Yeah, that was it, a free woman. With my looks and all that money, oh, would I have a time. I planned everything, told the neighbors Jay was going on a trip. I said Jay'd wrote me to sell the place and join him out of town. I tell you, it was perfect. He came home that night. The night I was gonna let him join his mama.
Anybody home?
I'm always home.
Oh, you said that just like Mama used to.
Did I?
Say, that reminds me. I got a new detective agency working on the case. They think that maybe she lost her memory somehow. You know, like you were in the
house. All right.
What, Ella?
Sit down and eat your supper. You want it to get cold?
Don't see why you don't want to talk about finding Mama. After all...
Sit down and eat your supper. You'll find her, Mama.
You think so, Ella?
Sure.
Oh, say, that's good hearing you say that. Finding my Ma, that's something I'm sure like.
He sat down to eat. I made him a good supper. Why not? His last supper. And then it happened. We were sitting there eating when there was a knocking at the door.
No. Who can that be?
How should I know? Get up and answer it.
Yeah. Peddler, I'll bet you. Nobody here.
Then shut the door and come on back and finish your supper.
That's funny. I heard knocking playing, didn't you?
Yeah, kid playing jokes. Go on, eat. I want you to help me fix something in the basement.
Fix what?
You'll see. Finish your eating first.
Okay.
This crazy kid. Nah, just where you are. I'll go and...
Ella, wait.
Wait for what?
Listen. That knocking. How funny it sounds.
Those kids.
But it's... from the basement door.
No.
Well, I better go see.
No. Jay, don't open that door. Don't, I tell you.
Don't see why not. Somebody knocking. I gotta see
her. Jay, leave the door closed.
What's the matter with you? Gotta open it. Gotta see.
No, Jay.
No. Mama. Mama. Mama!
Ladies and gentlemen, this moment when the dead have returned is certainly a fit one to loosen your grip on that chair and take a deep breath and slow up your pulse beat. And now back to Lights out. Stella goes on with her story. The story of the return from death of the woman she had murdered.
Yeah. It was her, all right. There she was. Eyes glaring. Dirty gray old hair plastered wet around her face. Standing there. I could see her with my own eyes. And yet she was dead, I tell you, dead. Jay didn't know that, no. He took that dead thing by the arm, and he led her into the room. And he sat her down in a chair.
Oh, Mama, Mama, you did come back. I knew you would. We both knew it, didn't we, Ella? Now tell us, Mama, where you been. Why'd you go? Yeah, why come back this funny way? The back way up the basement steps. Why, Mama? Mama, you're sick. Oh, Ella, look, she's dripping wet. Ella, quick, take her upstairs and put her to bed. Yeah, and maybe you'd better sleep with her tonight. Keep her warm. Ella? Why are you looking so funny? Ella! Ma! Ella fainted. Why did she faint? Why?
Sure, I fainted. Me sleep with that. Me keep that warm. Oh, no. I didn't wake up until next morning. Jay was leaving for work. He told me she was sleeping in her room to take good care of her when she woke up. When he went away, happy as Mama was back. When he was gone, I sat down there in the kitchen and waited. It got on to 5. Soon he'd be coming home. I had to know. Tell you, I had to. I went upstairs to her room. I opened the door. Nobody there. I tell you, nobody there. The bed not even slept in. She'd never been there, never. I dreamed it. Daydreamed it. She wasn't there. She hadn't come back. But I had to be sure. I went down in the basement. I pried up that old iron lid. There was the open well. I lit a lantern and held it in the black hole. I looked in. She was there, floating in the water like a big fat... Oh, but she was still there. Well, that's all that mattered. I had piled things over the lid to hold it down, and old trunk boxes, heavy things. That's what I did. Jay came home after a while. He said,
"How's Mama?"
I said, "All right." He said,
"Call her down to dinner, will you?"
I said, "Yeah, sure." Oh, yeah, that's what I said. I knew Mama was all right where she was. We sat down to dinner. He kept talking about her. How funny it was that she still was sleeping. How funny it was the way she came back. But all the time I was laughing inside myself because I knew what had happened was just a strange dream we both had had because she was dead. Dead and floating. We sat there eating. I felt good. A bad dream ended. For this night, Jay would join his mama. Woman. Yeah. And then... just like the night before, it happened.
Hey, now who in the world's that? And it's the basement door again. Now what in the... Mama! You!
Yeah, I screamed. What good was that? There she was again. The water dripping down off her face and clothes and puddling on the floor. And this time I knew it was no dream. She came into the room. She sat down on a chair. Jay talking all the time. He didn't see the way I saw that her
face was... started to thunder. Jay said...
Mama, Mama, you should never have sneaked out on a night like this. Not a bed with you. In the morning, I'll call the doctor. Ella, you take Mom upstairs to bed. And this time, be sure you sleep with her. You know how scared she is of thunder. Go on now. She's soaked to the skin.
I just sat there. I tell you, I couldn't move. Think of going upstairs with her, being in the same room with her. It froze me to my chair. And Jay said...
No. No, come to think of it, I'll go fetch the doctor right now. Can't take any more chances. Ella, you take Mama right upstairs and put her to bed. Lie down with her. Keep her warm till I get back with Doc Williams.
And he was gone. Gone after the doctor. I sat there, the flesh on me crawling. The doctor'd come and he'd see that she was dead, dead a long time. He'd be sure to see it the way I saw it, dead, and the water had... How long we sat there looking at each other, I don't know. And then her lips moved, and it was like a cold wind. I said to put me to bed. That's what she said. My son said to put me to bed. And then I understood the whole thing. She'd come back from the dead to keep me from killing him. And she wanted me along upstairs to... No, I wouldn't do it. I sat there without moving. Her lips moved again. He said to keep me warm. Come upstairs, Ella, to keep me warm. Me keeping that dead thing warm. Her wet, cold, dripping skin against... No, I wouldn't do it. She thought she'd make me crazy that way. Hold me in her bony arms until the sense in me ran out, the way the well water was running out of her. Make me crazy. Something to be locked away like they locked my own mother away. Crazy, crazy. Oh, no, that wouldn't happen to me. She wouldn't make me crazy, not me. I got to my feet. I turned quick before she could stop me. The basement door. I locked it behind me. I ran down the basement steps. Oh, I knew how to see her. The sure way, the only way. Oh, that's why I'm down here now. The rope around my neck. The other end tied to the crossbeam. I'll jump off this ladder. The rope will stretch. I'll be dead. Dead. And she'll never get me crazy. Still thundering. If I make noises, I choke. Nobody will hear me. And I'll die. And I'll never see her again. Why don't I do it now? There ain't much time. Jay and the doctor will be coming back. I gotta be dead then. Good and dead, or they'll find out the truth about her. Why don't I do it now? Why don't I do it? Because I'm afraid. Afraid of dying. That's why I've been talking here in the dark, because I'm afraid. Oh, it'll be so dark. Empty. Things will go on in the world, and I'll have nothing but the dark. Why should I die? Yeah, why should I? If I left this house, she wouldn't follow me, would she? That's all she wants, the house, her Jay. Well, she can have him. I'll go. I'll go right away. Far away, that they'll never find me, never. Oh, the rope. It's so tight around my neck. Oh, I gotta get it off. I gotta hurry and get away before Jay and the duck. I can't get the rope off. Who's there? Who's coming down the steps? Is that you, Jay? Oh, you. You followed me down.
How could you? I locked the door. Oh, but then I put that iron lid over you, too, didn't I? And it didn't do much good. Oh, listen. Listen, I'll go away. You hear me? I'll go away. This will be your house and everything in it. Hear me, all yours again. And Jay, I'll leave him, too. I won't take anything with me. I'll just go right away. Get the rope off. I'll go. You'll see me go. Oh, I made the noose so tight, I can't seem to... Mrs. Kroger, what are you going to do? Well, you're not going to climb up the ladder. Oh, no. No, stay off. Stay off, I tell you. Don't come closer. I can't stand you coming closer. Stay away, the ladder. The ladder will fall. The rope is still around my neck if I fall off. No. No. No, you won't make me die. I've got hold of the rope with my hands. I won't choke this way. My arms are strong. I can hold on to the rope above my head for a long time. Jay'll be home right away. He'll get me down. I'll live. I will, and you'll still be dead. Dead. I'll tell them that you fell in the well. They'll believe me. They'll believe me. Well, say something. Say something. I know you're standing down there watching me. You're waiting for my arms to get tired, so I'll let go. But I won't let go. I won't. He'll be home. I can't let go. I can't. I gotta live. Oh, Larry. Oh, I'm so tired. I gotta hold on. Or the noose. Oh, cramp in the arm. Jay, I got a cramp. I can't hold on anymore. Jay, I wouldn't have killed you. Oh, Jay, I can't hold on. Jay!
Last week and again this. You really believe the dead can return to avenge?
Well, I have an answer this week. A factual one. Yes, about the return of the dead, whether or not I believe that the dead could return to avenge an evil. Frank, have you ever heard of Charles Fort?
No, I haven't.
Well, Charles Hoyt Fort was born in 1874 and died in New York in 1932. The unusual, the supernormal, the supernatural fascinated him, just as one man might collect postage stamps. Charles Fort, for 20 or 30 years, collected records of phenomena which dogmatic science couldn't explain, strange murders and so forth. I suggest that, therefore, that any of you who think that this is the only possible world spend a very pleasant weekend reading these records in Mr. Fort's work, The Book of the Dead. Best possible answer to the ghost question is...
Later that you think.
Truth is stranger than fiction. And this is the proof. This is Ripley's. Believe it or not.
Colonel Peter Jefferson, who was the father of President Thomas Jefferson, could simultaneously upend two hogsheads of tobacco, each weighing 1,000 pounds, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about one of the strangest robberies in all history.
Do you know how old the school building in your community is? If it's over 25 years old, the chances are that it's woefully inadequate. Join with the groups in your community working for better school conditions. Remember, better schools build a stronger America.
In Lucerne, Switzerland, a grave robber in the mausoleum of General Ludwig Pfeiffer's wife got the scare of his lifetime. The general's wife, who had been interred in the mausoleum the night before, suddenly sat up in her coffin and screamed at him. The lady was still very much alive. Madame Pfeiffer, clad only in a shroud, walked all the way home and lived another 20 years. But she never smiled again. Believe it or not.
Everyone's heard of X minus one, right? It's considered to be the finest science fiction drama ever produced for radio. This doesn't mean it was the first. It certainly wasn't the first. That honor goes to 2000 plus. It wasn't the second. That would be Dimension X, which was very, very similar to X minus one. Most of the crew from Dimension X went to work for X minus one when it hit the air. In fact, the first 15 episodes of its 1956 to 1958 run on NBC were new versions of Dimension X episodes. The remainder were almost entirely adaptations of recently published science fiction stories, mostly from Galaxy Science Fiction magazine, usually written by some of the leading writers of the time, people like Philip K. Dick, Fritz Leiber, J.T. McIntosh, Robert A. Heinlein, Ted Sturgeon, and today's author, Robert Sheckley. Robert Sheckley, who was born in 1928, and died in 2005, was a Hugo and Nebula Award nominating author. He never did win, which was a shame, really. He would be named Author Emeritus of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association of America in 2001. This was an award that went to older writers of science fiction who had now mostly retired. Sheckley was at his best and most prolific in the 50s and 60s, but he did continue to write stories right up until the late 90s. He wrote hundreds of stories and a few books. Immortality Incorporated comes to mind. Immortality Incorporated was adapted, loosely adapted, I should say, into the movie Free Jack. The seventh victim was the basis for the much more successfully adapted tenth victim with Ursula Andress. Today's program is called Early Model, and it is an adaptation of Sheckley's story, which was originally published in August of 1956 in Galaxy magazine. X Minus One aired this for the first time on July the 11th of 1957. If you're not familiar with Sheckley, well, this is a fairly good introduction, but you really should look up some of his short stories and read them. This wouldn't be as hard as you might think, because there is this website, Free Science Fiction Online, which features, oh, I don't know, probably a dozen of his stories, all downloadable, all absolutely free. I'll put a link on the webpage in the segment devoted to this particular show. It'll be down at the bottom. You won't have much trouble. Go read this stuff. It's great.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
from the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Now, X minus one, and the Robert Sheckley story, Early Model.
Of course, Professor Sligert claimed the trouble was that the Protech was an early model, but then he invented it. He sprung the thing on me just before I took off for my scouting contact mission to Tells 4 in the Betelgeuse sector.
Here, Bentley, put this on.
What is it?
A new model. It's called a Protech.
What's it for?
Now, you'll wear it on your mission.
Now, look, Sligert, I already have to carry enough equipment to give varicose veins to an elephant. Linguacine, that's 22 pounds. I can't do without it, or I can't translate native languages. Concentrated food, water, subspace radio, weapons, medical kit. Now, how much does this thing weigh?
72 pounds. Try it on.
Look, I won't promise
to take... It fits right on your back. Here, I'll snap the harness. Fits fine.
It digs into my back. There's a sharp thing back
there. That's the sensory link. It has to be at that angle.
But my back...
We're working on the problem. Now, don't worry.
What does it do?
Protech is the perfect protection for initial planet contact. There are pseudo-protein computer banks and an Anderson-Woodward force field projector. Wherever the Protech senses danger... Here, look, I'll show you. I take this slide rule and swing at you.
Hey, where did everybody go? Who turned out the lights? Hey, Sligert, where am I? Sligert! Get me out of here! Sligert! What happened?
The Protech went on.
Ooh.
It encased you in the AW force field. I released by master control. You can turn it off with this button on your chest. Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, but 73 pounds.
Well, this is an early model. I've used every weight-saving device possible, but unfortunately, early models are always a little bulky.
All right, all right. How do I take it off?
I'm not going to tell you.
Huh?
We're not going to take chances of having valuable equipment discarded just because it might be a little uncomfortable. Bentley, you're going to an alien planet. It's necessary that you be protected at all times.
Look, I've got enough sense to figure out when to wear this thing.
Yeah, suppose you find a native seemingly friendly, you'd want to take off this heavy, uncomfortable Protech. But suppose you misjudge their attitude.
Sligert, I can take care of myself.
That's what Atwood said before he left for Atopus 3. We never heard from him. Bentley, can you turn a knife thrust from the rear? Have you got eyes in the back of your head? Protech has. We're not going to risk $8 million worth of equipment just because you might be uncomfortable.
Suppose it blows a fuse or pops a wire.
We've got triple everything, with a power supply good for a century. Bentley, after this field test, the Protech will be standard equipment for all explorers.
Well, all right. I'll try to get used to it. But it feels like I'm carrying a 72-pound monkey on my back. I carried it for 6 weeks on the way to Tells 4. And the added weight loused up my coordination in landing, so I burned out about 7 acres with backlash from the braking tubes. The radio receiver buried in my ear itched, and my back was rubbed raw from the carrying straps. I piled on my linguacine and the other equipment and staggered out. My instructions were to fraternize with the Aborigines and establish a trade pact if possible. I found two of them standing outside the tail fins when the hull had cooled enough to get out. They were bipeds, orange-skinned with thick, short tails, and they were armed with stone axes and clubs. I stepped out of the lock, and they started talking fast. I realized I hadn't turned on my linguacine, so I tuned it in and threw the switch.
I dare say it's a manifestation of some supernatural quality, eh, Wassel, old chap?
Without a doubt, old man.
You know how the linguacine works, instantaneous semantic translation. Well, mine was made by the Gorley Laboratories just outside London, and naturally they had the word tapes recorded by BBC announcers. It takes a little getting used to when you hear some walking vegetable from the Canopus system talking like the Helm service. Well, the Tellians were pretty excited by my arrival.
How strange. Unbelievable.
Most improper, you know.
I suppose it can talk.
I come as a friend. A friend.
Well,
it does talk. Dreadful accent. But what can you expect, eh?
Foreigners, you know.
You know, old boy?
I definitely sense an evil.
Oh, now, come. We're both ghost doctors. Surely if there was an evil, we'd both sense it.
Well, let's ask, shall we?
Let's.
I say, are you evil? Me?
Why, yes. You see, we're the village ghost doctors. It's our job to ferret out evil, so to speak.
It's our cup of fugal, so to speak.
Are you evil?
Oh, no. No.
He says he's not evil.
Well, how do you know?
If he doesn't, who does?
My dear fellow, appearances aren't everything. Surely you recall the legend of Hatape, the gods tempted the chief...
Please, my dear chap, I'm as well aware of religious precedent as you are.
The two of them stood there, lashing their orange tails, accusing each other of heresy. The linguistine finally couldn't handle the theological discussion and cut out before overload blew a circuit. Eventually, they must have decided something because the short one carrying the stone axe turned to me.
Stranger, we've decided not to kill you.
Not yet, anyway. We'll go to the village and purify ourselves, then we'll initiate you into the club.
The club? The Society of Ghost Doctors. You see, no evil thing can become a ghost doctor. Just isn't done, you know.
Oh, we'll find out the truth that way. Clever, eh?
I'm deeply grateful.
But if you're evil, we'll destroy you. Have to. Our job, you know.
Sligert, calling Professor Sligert at home base. Come in.
Go ahead, Bentley. Report.
I'm in the village now. They're about to initiate me as some kind of priest. All I have to do is pass some kind of tests. And, by the way, if I don't pass, they're going to kill me.
Ah, that's good.
What's funny?
They can't hurt a hair on your head, not with Protek on the job.
They seem awfully confident that they can.
Primitive cultures always overestimate the power of their weapons. Don't worry. Just let Protek take care of you.
Go ahead, old boy. It's purified ceremonial food.
But I can't.
Why not? We purified with 7 sprinklings of strychnine, according to ritual.
It's a taboo. I'm only allowed to eat my own supplies. A tribal taboo, you know.
How primitive.
Positively pagan.
Well, shall we get on with it? We'll dispense with the written exam and get right down to the oral.
Tell me, what do you think of evil?
Well... Well, it isn't good.
Ah.
Well put.
Well, in that case, you have no objection to receiving the sacred and very holy spear that Cran Clue brought down from the abode of the small gods, the brandishing of which brings good on a man?
Oh, I would be honored to receive it.
Very well, then. The ceremony can commence.
Oh, stranger from the skies, accept from us the spear of sanctity. Evil cannot abide the presence of this spear. Take then our blessings with it. Here, here, O stranger, take the spear!
What? Confounded Protek, where's that release button? Sligert, Sligert, come in! He's probably out to lunch. Gotta get that force field off. There! Listen, I'm terribly sorry,
begin
but
the purification dirge! We are in the presence of evil spirits!
Oh, no, I can explain!
You cannot accept the sacred spear?
Well, you see, I've got this protective device. It's sort of like a shield, you know? It doesn't like spears. It doesn't trust them. You couldn't give me a sacred gourd?
Nonsense. Who ever heard of a sacred gourd?
Poppycock! Look, you'll just have to take my word for it. I'm not evil, really. Scout's honor!
Our course is clear.
Transparent.
We won't kill you at once. We'll pray for you through the night. And perhaps in the morning, things will turn out better. If not...
Sorry, old boy, but you understand our position. We'll just have to kill you. Can't be helped. Regulations, you know.
Yes, yes, Bentley, I understand. Well, primitive people are notoriously treacherous. They might have stabbed you with the spear.
Look, Sligert, I'm positive there was no such intent. After all, you have to start trusting people sometime.
Not with $1 billion worth of equipment in your charge.
Don't you understand? The Protek wouldn't let me accept their sacred spear. That means I might be evil. Now, what if I can't pass the initiation test tomorrow? Look, tell me how to take it off.
Oh, no. We want you back alive. There's no way they can hurt you through the Protek field. Now, try to have a little faith.
The campfires burned all night, and I could hear the chants of the ghost doctors. At least three or four times during that night, the Protect force field howled on and off, but I was too tired to care. In the morning, the two Tellians came to see me and stood switching their fat orange tails politely while the linguacene translated for me.
There were great sounds from your hut last night, sounds of torment, as if you were wrestling with a devil, so to speak.
I'm a restless sleeper.
Yes. Yes, of course.
Quite.
By the way, Elting, did you pray for purification last night?
Hmm? Oh, yes, 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 I did.
And was your prayer granted?
Yes, oh, yes, sure, certainly. Not a bit of evil around me.
Well, if you can't be initiated, we'll have to destroy you.
We made that clear, didn't we?
Oh, yes, quite clear. The initiation ritual took the whole day. It was sort of a cross between a Shriners' convention and a performance of Das Rheingold at the Met. Luckily, no one tried to hand me a ceremonial spear or point a club in my direction, so the Protect kept its grimy force field to itself. Finally, around supper time, the Tellians pounded the last tail on the ground, and everyone stopped and paid close attention.
Oh, brothers, this alien has come across the vast emptiness to be our brother. With this initiation, we purge him of evil and make him one of us. Brother, now you are a ghost doctor with all the privileges and perquisites pertaining thereto. And in friendship, I extend to you the claw of friendship.
Well, thanks.
We have only to shake claws, and the ceremony is concluded.
All right, brother. Give me some skin. Slip me seven. No, no, listen, turn it off. He just wants to shake hands. You're spoiling everything. Off, off. Now, where's that button? Off!
Evil! Evil! Evil. Well, there it is, you know. We hoped we could muddle through, but you can't win them all, you know. There's only one thing left. Kill the devil!
About 30 of the Tellians heaved stone spears at me, and naturally I disappeared inside the Anderson Woodward force field, and the spears rattled off the whining coruscating power sphere. I tried to walk back to the ship, but the Protect went on about every half step, and at that rate it would take me about a month to cover the ground. I figured I'd wait him out. And then I noticed that the air inside the field began to go stale. I came out of the field. The Tellians were sitting around. Rennick picked up a spear.
Evil.
Wait, wait. Hold off. Fins. Fair play.
Fair play?
I say, Rennick, he's due a 3-minute sanction under the sacred law of Hisipple.
You really think so?
He invoked fair play.
True. True. All right, monster. You have 3 minutes.
Thanks. Hello. Hello, Sliggard. Come in, Sliggard.
Ah, there you are, Bentley.
Listen, you've got to get me out of this. They're trapping me in the Protect.
You mean the Protect is saving you from harm?
No, no, they keep activating it. They'll starve me out.
Now, don't get panicky. Just sit tight in the Protect field till they see they can't harm you.
Oh, you confounded idiot. There's no air in there. The force field cuts it off. I'll choke.
Oh, oh dear, that's true, isn't it? Don't worry. We'll correct that in future models.
Oh, thanks a lot. But what am I going to do right now? How do I get this thing off?
Well, now I am sorry. To tell the truth, I designed the harness so that you couldn't get out under any circumstances.
Oh, you lousy...
Please, please, let's keep our heads. If you can hold out for a couple of months, we might be able
to... I can't. The air, the water... And I hate to mention it, but they seem to be building fires around me.
I'm sorry. Your 3 minutes are up. We are going to destroy you with fire.
Yeah, it's traditional. My dear chap, would you like to kindle the first blaze?
Oh, after you, old fellow. Remember, I burned the last evil monster.
True, true. Oh, monster.
Yes?
Do you have a light?
I knew I was cooked, one way or the other. They started to light fires around me in a circle, and the Protect snapped on. I had to get out. Of course, when I did, the Tellians would cheerfully spear me to death. But at least I had a chance of running. The field snapped on again. I grabbed my knife from the tool chest and hacked at the thick duroplastic webbing of the harness. I came out of the field long enough to hear Sliggard shouting in my ear.
What are you doing?
Cutting my way out of this fire trap.
You don't dare destroy government equipment. This will go down on your 201 file.
Look, I'm trapped inside the field as long as they feed the fire. And considering how they feel about devils, they'll probably keep it up a couple of hundred years. Uh-oh. They're pushing the fire closer. Goodbye. I
I tore at the straps with my wire cutters and knife. I could only work when the field was off. The ProTec protected itself. Finally, I ripped the harness off just as the field went on, and I was thrown 20 feet into the fire. But I landed on my feet and was off and running. It took the Tellians just 100 yards to catch up and gently lay a stone club along the side of my head. Oh, well, let's get it over with. You're going to kill me. Let's not make a production out of it.
Oh, but my dear fellow, we don't want to kill you.
Dear me, no. We knew you were a good man. It was the devil we wanted.
I don't mean to be tactless, but you do know you had a devil riding on your back.
We were trying to purify him, but he was too strong. The fire took the starch out of him, though.
A devil? A devil on my back? Oh, yeah, yeah, I guess so, yes.
You know, our village is very proud to have such a powerful devil chained up inside a fire ring.
Tell me, my dear chap, you haven't by any chance any more devils like that in your homeland?
No, that's the only one.
Pity.
Huh?
We'd really be tickled orange if we could have a few more to worship, you know.
You mean trade for them?
Why, yes. I'm sure every village would want one.
Well, I think that can be arranged, and you haven't seen anything. We'll sell you devils that really are devils. After all, this one is just an early model.
X-1 has brought you Early Model, a story from the pages of Galaxy, written by Robert Sheckley and adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in our cast were Bob Hastings, Joseph Bell, Anthony Kemble Cooper, and Alastair Duncan. This is Fred Collins speaking. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Ted Chamberlain. It's a Small Solar System by Alan Howard. Know him? Well, you might say I practically grew up with him. He was my hero in those days. I thought few wiser or greater men ever lived. In my eyes, he was greater than Babe Ruth, Lindy, or the President. Of course, time and my growing up caused me to bring him into a perspective that I felt to be more consonant with his true position in his field of endeavor. When he died, his friends mourned for fond remembrance of things past. But privately, many of them felt that he had outlived his best days. Now, with this glorious vindication, I wonder how many of them are still alive to feel the twinge of conscience. Oh, we were delighted, of course, but it seems incredible even today to us elated oldsters. Although we were always his staunchest admirers, in retrospect, we can see now that no one believed more than we that he did it strictly for the dollar. It is likely there was always a small core of starry-eyed adolescents who found the whole improbable saga entirely believable, or at least half-believed if it might be partly true. The attitude of the rest of us ranged from a patronizing disparagement that we thought was expected of us, through grudging admiration, to out-and-out enthusiasm. Now, certainly, if anybody had taken the trouble to consider it, and why should they have, the landing of the first manned ship on our satellite seemed to render him as obsolete as the horde of other lesser and even greater lights. At any rate, it was inevitable that the conquest of the moon would be merely a stepping stone to more distant points. Oh no, I had nothing to do with the selection of the Red Planet. Coming in as head of Project P4 in its later stages, as I did when Dr. Fredericks died, the selection had already been made. Yes, it's quite likely I may have been plunging for Mars below the conscious level. A combination of chance, expediency, and popular demand made Mars the next target, rather than Venus, which was, in some ways, the more logical goal. I would have given anything to have gone, but the metaphorical stout heart that one reporter once credited me with is not the same as an old man's actual fatty heart. And there were heartbreak years ahead before the Goddard was finally ready. During this time, he slipped further into obscurity while big, important things were happening all around us. You're right. That one really big creation of his is bigger than ever. It has passed into the language and meant employment for thousands of people. Too few of them have even heard of him. Of course, he was still known and welcomed by a small circle of acquaintances, but to the world at large, he was truly a forgotten man. It is worthy of note that one of the oldest of these acquaintances was present at blastoff time. He happened to be the grandfather of a certain competent young crewman. The old man was a proud figure during the brief ceremonies, and his eyes filled with tears as the mighty rocket climbed straight up on its fiery tail. He remained there gazing up at the sky long after it had vanished. He was heard to murmur, "I'm glad the kid could go, but it's just a lark to him. He never had a sense of wonder." How could he? Nobody reads anymore. Afterward, his senile emotions betrayed him. He broke down completely and had to be led from the field. It is rumored he did not live long after that. The Goddard drove on until Mars filled the viz screen. It was planned to make at least a half a dozen braking passes around the planet for observational purposes before the actual business of bringing the ship in for a landfall began. As expected, the atmosphere proved to be thin. The speculated Dead Sea areas, oddly enough, turned out to be just that. To the surprise of some, it was soon evident that Mars possessed, or had possessed, a high civilization. The Canali of Schiaparelli were indeed broad waterways stretching from pole to pole, too regular to be anything but work of intelligence. But most wonderful of all were the scattered but fairly numerous large, walled cities that dotted the world. Everybody was excited, eager to land and start exercising their specialties. One of the largest of these cities was selected more or less at random. It was decided to set down just inside, yet far enough from the walls to avoid any possibility of damage from the landing jets in the event the city was inhabited. Even if deserted, the entire scientific personnel would have raised a howl that would have been heard back on Earth if just a section of wall was scorched. When planetfall was completed, and observers had time to scan the surroundings, it was seen that the city was very much alive. "What keeps them up?" marveled Kupchinski, the aeronautics and rocketry authority. The sky swarmed with ships of strange design. The walls were crowded with inhabitants, too far away for detailed observation. Even as they looked, an enormous gate opened and a procession of mounted figures emerged. In the event the place was deserted, the captain would have had the honor of being the first to touch Martian soil. While atmospheric and other checks were being run, he gave orders for the previously decided alternative. Captain, semanticist, and anthropologist would make the first contact. With all checks agreeing that it was safe to open locks, soon the three representatives of Earth were walking shoulder to shoulder down the ramp. It was apparent that the two scientists purposely missed stride inches from the end, so that it was the captain's foot that actually touched ground first. The cavalcade, though these beasties were certainly not horses, was now near enough to the ship for details to be seen. Surprise and wonderment filled the crew, for while the multi-legged steeds were as alien as anyone might expect to find on an alien world, the riders were very definitely humanoid. Briefly, brightly, and barbarically trapped as they were by earthly standards, they seemed to be little distinguishable from homegrown Homo saps. The approaching company appeared to be armed mainly with swords and lances, but also in evidence were some tubular affairs that could very well be some sort of projectile discharging device. The captain suddenly felt uncomfortably warm. It was a heavy responsibility. He hoped these Martians wouldn't be the type of madmen who believed in the shoot-first-inquire-later theory. Even as he stood there, outwardly calm but jittering internally, the Martian riders pulled up 10 feet from the Earthmen. Their leader, tall, dark-haired, and subtly lighter in hue than his companions, dismounted and approached the captain. With outstretched hand, he took the captain's in a firm grip. Let it be recorded here, to the shame of an Earth where reading for pleasure is virtually a lost pastime, that not one man on the Goddard realized the significance of what followed. "How do you do?" he said in perfect English, with an unmistakable trace of Southern accent. "Welcome to Barsoom. My name is John Carter." End of It's a Small Solar System by Alan Howard. Recording by Ted Chamberlain, Puyallup, Washington. You'll find me on the web at voiceoverman.com, VOISOVER-MAN.com.
Lady Esther 4-Purpose Face Cream does the four things your skin needs most for beauty. And it's so gentle and soft, you don't have to massage and rub at your skin. My cream itself does the work, not your fingers. And it needs no help from any other cream. Try this with Lady Esther four-purpose face cream. Sure as you do, someone will say to you, "Why, I've never seen you look so rested, so fresh and young. You know, you look like a young girl in love."
Well, it's later. Perhaps even later than you think. Maybe you should look at the clock. In 1939, with his own money, Arch Obler recorded an audition record of his play, The Ugliest Man in the World. It was from this that he hoped to launch a new radio series of idea plays. Taking the recording to his network, NBC, which was at that time looking to launch an experimental radio series to rival CBS's Columbia Workshop, they gave Obler his series without a sponsor and with complete creative control. This was very unusual. Calling the series Arch Obler's Plays was not Arch Obler's idea. I'll give you an idea of the standing of this man. And their faith would be justified. It was so successful that it attracted a sponsorship from Procter & Gamble quite quickly and was retitled Everyman's Theater. It didn't have a long run. It ran from 1940 to early 1941. Obler was really kind of unhappy. No, not kind of. Obler was really unhappy with commercialism in this program. He did not like that they had a commercial in the middle of them. He felt that it really disrupted the flow of things. Arch had a reputation for at times being difficult to work with, and it was almost a year before Obler's services were called on again. This is an Arch Obler's play, The Ways of Men, Past, Present, and Future, and it aired on April the 13th, 1939. I guess this is the future.
Arch Obler's Plays. On the winds of the night, we bring you a story whispered in the night. Three short plays of the ways of men, past, present, and future. First, the past. The time, one of our yesterdays. The place, the main square of the village. It had once been a tree-circled gathering point for the women and old men to sun themselves. On its clean pavements, the children had played. But now the trees stand charred and broken. Blocks of jagged masonry lie piled in empty disorder. There is no village, only hovels clustering on the edge of great shell-blasted craters. One thing alone rises complete, shining new in the early morning sun, a crudely fashioned statue of a man. And before this statue stand a small boy and a bent old man. The boy speaks.
But were there so many people before the trouble, Grandfather?
The people? Yes, yes. Hundreds and hundreds of people. The square here would be filled with them of a sunny day. The old ones sitting, the young ones strolling, the children playing. Hundreds, I tell you. Hundreds.
And were there many boys like me in the village then?
Aye, that there were. Playing their games, marching around and around to the music of the band.
Band?
Aye, band, before the trouble. The band that played and told our men they had to fight.
Fight whom, Grandfather?
Our enemies, of course. Kill or be killed, the poster said. March on the enemy for the glory of the eternal state. Oh, yes. That's what the posters said, all over the town. It's as if I hear them now. The band playing here in the square, the women talking war talk, the men seizing their guns, guns. All but one, Jan Peyro. And him they hated. Hated.
Orderly!
Commandant. That confounded band. Shut the window. Yes, Commandant.
Now then, young men. We will settle your case.
I am waiting, Your Excellency.
Speak only when I tell you to.
As you say, Your Excellency.
Your name?
Jan. Jan Piero.
Occupation?
I am a farmer. My land is just beyond the furthest hill.
Family?
Wife and child.
According to this report, you have refused to join the armies of the state. Is that true?
I have never denied it.
Then what they say is true. You are afraid to die.
Give me a reason to die.
Reason? Are you such a fool that you have not understood what even the children in the streets are saying? That even now our enemies prepare to crush us?
That is what they say.
Enemies! They must strike them down. They must attack for the glory of our homes and wives and children.
It's such an old tune.
Eh?
My father and his father before him danced out his life to it.
But our enemies prepare. They hate us. Men, women, and children.
Yeah, but why do our enemies hate us?
Because...
I'll tell you. Because of that great victory won in my father's time. And in that victory were sown the seeds of this new war you ask me to die in. Oh, don't you understand?
Silence! Orderly!
Where, Commandant?
The Burgermeister. Send him in.
Run, Commandant.
Your Excellency, I know I am only a farmer.
No,
but I
won't listen to you, Jan Perro. I know your sort. Talk, 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 until a man's head spins in the middle like a top.
Burgermeister, Your Excellency.
Come in, Burgermeister. Come in.
Yes, yes, Your Excellency. Whatever I can do for you.
You can do nothing for me. Here is your Jan Perro. See that he listens to reason. I give you 2 minutes.
Well, Jan, Burgermeister.
Oh, you won't disgrace us, Jan.
Why won't you listen to me? If I fight, if we fight, there will be no victory.
Oh, we'll win a glorious victory.
I say win or lose, there will be no victory. The hatred fighting breeds does not die with a victory. It lives on in the hearts of the defeated.
Protect your home and loved ones, Jan.
But we have not been attacked. No, Burgermeister. Protect my son and my son's sons from dying. That's what I'll do. I will not fight. I will not fight. I will not fight.
Jan.
Do not weep, little wife.
But I heard.
What you heard were only words the commandant squeezed to frighten me. I spoke only the truth, my wife. He knows I did.
Jan, do what they say.
You want me to go to war? Because you cannot stand people's empty words?
Everyone is going, Jan. You must too.
Anna, my silly little one. You don't know what you're saying.
Do what they say, Jan. Do it.
No.
You are afraid. You are.
Anna.
Afraid to fight. To protect your home, your wife, your child. Afraid.
Yes. Yes. I am afraid.
Afraid?
But not afraid of what you think, my wife. Not afraid of the quick death of a smashing bullet in my head. No. I'm not afraid of the slow death. Squirming in the mud of a stinking trench. With my blood pouring from me like a burning fire. I tell you, I am not afraid to die in battle, my wife. I am afraid that I might not die.
What?
I'm afraid that I'd live through this war and come back and see the years go by and watch the next war brewing. Watch my son fed with the lies they are trying to feed me. Watch the new hates growing in those other lands. The hates my rifle had helped shoot into their hearts and minds. That's what I'm afraid of, my wife. That's why I will never fight. That's why I'll never...
Jan. Jan, they're coming for you.
Eh? For me?
Well, look!
Oh, no.
Jan Perro.
Eh? What?
By order of the Emergency Military Tribunal, you are to be executed on the charge of high treason. That execution to take place at once.
Jan!
Yeah.
Commandant.
Well, Jan Perro, will you fight for peace and glory?
You mean to shoot me?
In 3 minutes by the clock.
The wall behind me. All of my church.
Blindfold the prisoner.
No, wait. I want to see them. The crowd there. Look. They were my friends. You there, Eric. I see you. Why do you call me names? We were in school together. You were my friend. Please understand me. You there, Hans. Remember the long talks we had together of beauty and the brave new life? You, Hans, tell them what I mean when I say the door. No, they will not listen. You see, Commandant, look at them. My friends. Even the thought of war, and already they are not men of the soil, men of the shops, but things of hate. And that hate will not stop when the terms of peace are signed. It cannot stop. Another moment. Brothers of my village, listen to me. Before those bullets tear me open, listen to me. I have lived with you, worked with you, all the years of my life. And if my life is ending now, here among you, that is good. Better my blood soak into this, my native soil, than in another land. My blood that flows here ends here. But yours will flow like a great river of hate, joining the hate of our fathers and our enemies, until it is a great sea washing over all the world, blotting it out like a flood. Do not give your blood to that sea of hate, my countrymen. Do not fight, and there will be no war. Fight, and there will be no peace. For in the peace you dictate will be our children's war. And when the new war comes, it will rain from the sky, a great green chunky cloud. It will blot out the village. All men will grovel in burrows beneath the ground, with their women like hunted things. The great city, the men will crash. Wolves will howl among the broken things we call our glory. Violence breeds violence, my brothers. There can be no peace through war.
Fire!
There can be no peace through war. There can...
And so he died, Jan Perro, many years ago. Died against a church wall that was dust long before the day of trouble. The day when all that he said came true, and the world went up in flames of hate.
But the statue, Grandfather.
This statue? Oh, yes. Frederick the Blind and I, we were the only men left in all the village. We made it with our own hands. Look close and read the words, my son. Read.
It says... To the memory of Jan Perro, the bravest man in all the village.
And now the second in our short plays of The Ways of Men, a story of the present. The scene aboard the U.S. destroyer Liberty, somewhere in the Mediterranean. It is dusk. The usual disciplined calm of the battleship has been broken for the past half hour by a minor tragedy of the sea. In the heavy fog, a small fishing skiff had been cut down by the lunging prow of the destroyer. At the moment, the senior officer is making his report to the commandant.
No doubt, sir, from the testimony of the men on deck, that not only was the skiff operating without a foghorn, but she didn't have a light on it either, horn or aft.
That's all very well, Lieutenant. But what I want to know is, how about the boy?
Oh, he's all right, sir. Not a thing wrong with him. Raising the devil good and proper, that he is, sir.
Eh? What do you mean?
Well, sir, it's a boat he wants.
A boat?
Aye, sir, a boat. The minute he hit the deck, he began yelling for a boat in place of the one we ran down.
Put him below deck until morning.
Oh, but that won't help, sir. It's the baby that's got us worried.
baby?
Aye, sir, baby, sir. The one the lad brought with him. 10 or 12 months old is how I rate it.
Lieutenant, perhaps you're not aware that I saw the boy brought over the side. He was alone.
Aye, sir, alone. But all the time he had this kid, I mean this baby, wrapped up snug under his coat. Didn't know it was there, we didn't. Until all at once he takes it out and starts dressing it in the dry stuff we gave him.
Well, I'll be...
Aye, sir.
Whose baby is it? Who's the boy? What was he doing out here in the fog in a small boat without running lights?
Well, that's just it, sir. He won't tell us.
Eh?
Just keeps yelling for a boat right away, quick. Kid under one arm and waving his fist, yelling to see the captain. It's one hell of a mess, sir.
There, sir. Do you hear him?
Send him in.
Aye, sir.
You, boy. The commander will see you. In here.
This is him, sir. I mean, them, sir.
Very good, Lieutenant.
Aye, sir.
Come closer, boy.
Boy, can't you do something about that child?
Mother Capitan, senor.
Aye, Mr. Roberts. Now that baby, can't you do something about him?
Quiet, little flower. This is the Capitan. He will help us. Quiet, little sister.
Well, she certainly listens to you.
As you will listen to me, Capitan. A boat. You will give me a boat. I must have a boat quickly. Do not stand there.
All right, boy. That's about enough of that. You'll be taken care of.
You mean that, senor?
Certainly.
Then you will give me a boat now?
Boy, try and understand. This is a government ship. I'm sure proper compensation will be made for your loss.
The words, senor. All of them I do not understand. This I know. A boat. Give me a boat, senor. There is no time. We must go.
Stop that. Didn't you hear me? I said you'd be taken care of, you and your sister. We'll get you back where you belong. Is that clear?
A hole in the ground.
Eh?
A hole in the ground is good enough for me, senor. But my sister, I do not think even you would want that for her.
What are you talking about?
You said you will take us back where we came from.
Well?
The bombs made great holes, senor.
Where are you from?
Aquila.
Oh.
My sister asks you to. You will give us another boat, senor?
Your family?
I told you, senor, I told you. Hole in the ground.
I'm sorry. Aquila, it's 200 miles from sea. Battle area. Boy, how did you manage to... You don't mind answering a few questions, do you?
Questions? Questions, senor? You ask me? No. I have questions I have wanted to ask for many days. You have gray hair. You are old. They always tell me the old are wise. So now you tell me, senor.
What?
Senor, why did they die?
Oh. Well, it's a war, boy. Difference of ideas. Someday you'll understand.
Understand, senor? What is there to understand? Have they understood to milk the cow? Jimenez understood how to make baskets to sell in the marketplace. Teresa, she understands how to beat the clothes white on the stones of the river. Juana, how to take care of her 5 children. But war, senor. It was so good in our village. The sun so bright, the air so clear. What had we to do with war? Make me understand, senor. Why are they all dead?
Well, civil war, as I said, difference of ideas. How can I explain?
My papa tells me many things. He talked to me of a world where men think free and talk free, where everyone has his own land, not too much, and men are like brothers. Is this why my papa is dead, senor? Is this why bombs drop from the sky?
Boy, listen to me.
No, senor. You do not know. You are not wise. No one who is old is wise. I must go. A boat, senor. Give me of my boat.
Boy.
Listen to us, senor. Our village was full of such laughter. Where is it now? Only Maruja and me. But her I take away to some place where there is nobody old and wise to drop bombs on her.
So that's where you were sailing.
See. We came so far until I found the boat. Then the sea... We were so happy. All at once, your ship, so fast, I could not get us out of the way. She's so little, senor. So pretty. When she's afraid, she never cry. Just look at me like she say, "Brother, you take good care of me." I will take it. I will. Give me a boat, senor. Give me a boat.
All right, Warren. It'll be all right.
Senor.
This is your boat.
Mine.
I'll take you to a place where, God willing, you and your sister will be safe.
You know such a place, senor?
Yes. We're not so old there. We haven't forgotten that liberty is not a gift, but a victory.
Look, senor. She has gone to sleep, my sister. It was because now she knows I can take care of her.
Take her outside, boy. The lieutenant will give you a place to sleep.
Gracias, senor. You are good. I thought there was no one left who was good. Gracias, senor.
Sleep well, boy.
Radio room.
Make the following addition to message sent to flagship. Quote, in Reese skiff run down in fog. There were two survivors, a boy and a baby. We are proceeding on course. We are taking children home.
Third play, the time 20,000 years from tomorrow.
Excuse me, please. I know it isn't polite. I can't help it. It's the funniest thing. Wait until you hear it. Absolutely the funniest thing. Yes, I'll tell you. A hoax. He tried to play a hoax on me, telling me it was an authentic record of their times and expecting me. Me to believe. No. Wait a moment. I'll start from the beginning. Really, I will. And then you'll laugh with me. I know you will. Well, it started like this. An old man comes to my study a little while ago, a package under his arm, and he tells me he's a student of the past. Past master of the humbug, that's what he meant. Wait until you hear it. So he has this package under his arm, and he says to me breathlessly,
"Kind sir, I've brought you the most wonderful relic of the past the modern world has ever known."
"Really?" I said. "What are you talking about, and who are you?" He answers,
"A lonely traveler, one who wanders in far-off places."
Far-off places. And that's what he told me. And so I said, "And is this that you are bringing me from one of these far-off places?" He nods his head like a strutting rooster. He says,
"Yes, indeed. You are the greatest living scholar of the history of the old world. So it is fitting that I bring this to you."
"Indeed," I said. "And what have you got, and where did you find it?" He says,
"I was walking through the mountains beneath which the great city once stood."
"Well," I said, "well," he said,
"as you know, thousands of years ago, there was another civilization that reached great heights."
"Yes, I know, I said. "Certainly you're not going to teach me history, my ancient friend." He said,
"Oh, no, indeed. I only meant to say what I found high in the mountain. It is a written record of that civilization, the first written record ever to be found."
For a moment, I couldn't breathe. I just looked at it. I said, "Have you gone out of your head with age, old man?" Nothing is left of that prehistoric time. First the sea covered them when the dark planet swung close, and then the molten rock thrust up. It is only our theory that men had a civilization here before us. For answer, he tore the paper off the package. He said,
"Look, these papers. Reality, I tell you.
High in the mountains, inside a piece of alabaster that must have protected it from the ravages of time. Miraculously spewed up from the earth when the mountains rose up through the land. Look, sir, and read. A record of their times. A record of the ways of men. 20,000 years before our civilization came into being.
Yes, he said that. And I took the book, took it in my hand, and read. For a moment, I almost believed the fraud. Strange formations of letters and strange words and meanings, but clear enough to me. Clear enough. The cleverest fraud a faker ever tried to perpetrate. Now, wait. Hey, let me tell you what was in that historical book he tried to tell me that he'd found, the old humbug. Listen to this. First, the book said... Wait until you hear this. First, the book said that the men of that past civilization fought about the land. You don't understand what I mean? I mean the world. They fought each other, maimed each other, bled each other over who owned what pieces of the world. Did you ever hear such nonsense? They knew how large the world was, and they knew how many men were in it. But instead of dividing it up fairly, or all owning together as one, they fought each other. Yes, bloody wars for years and years. Did you ever hear such humbug history? And that isn't all. The book said that they fought each other over race. Yes, race. The book says the word means the difference between men. And then the book said that all men have the same origin. And yet... They killed each other over a difference they admitted didn't even exist. Oh, what a fraud, that book. And a man walked that world for a little while who said, for the glory of God, peace on earth. And he spoke truth. And men listened and said, we believe. And then went out to murder with bright music playing. Music, I tell you. And then a little man arose who said, for the glory of the state, war on earth. And he spoke lies. And men knew they were lies, and he knew they knew. But again, they went out to murder with the music playing. And here's the funniest. Other men saw what was happening. And they said, let them kill. It is not to our interest. And the flame of murder came closer. And still they said, it is not our interest. As if the house were afire, and they said, we will not use water until we ourselves are burning. And here's the climax. The preposterous book said that these crazy people who filled the earth in those days had machines. Machines with which to fly through the air. Yes, really, through the air. But imagine the wonder if it were true. Speeding through the air like the birds, great glistening machines to carry men to new wonders. Guess what the front of the book said they did with them. I can hold your sides when you hear this. They loaded them up with horrible, tearing things and flew up over the crowded places and dropped them. Yes, believe me. The humbug history tried to make me believe that was the truth. They struggled for centuries. Men studied, toiled, rivers of heartache, said the book, trying to make a healthier world for their children to live in. And then they throw poison clouds down from the sky and kill them off in tens of thousands. Kill the children. Isn't it all a joke?
Arch Obler's plays are presentations of the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.